Hello, it's Tom here. We've got a brilliant episode of Last Orders for you today. But before we get into that, I just want to quickly remind you all about Spiked Supporters. This is our thriving donor community for those of you who give to Spiked regularly. So now those who give £5 or more each month or £50 or more each year can get exclusive perks. You can comment on articles, you can get discounts on all items in our shop, and you can get free and discounted tickets to Spiked events. So if you'd like to come along to any of our upcoming events, which we'll be announcing soon, and you're not already a Spiked supporter, then why not sign up today? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to find out more and to sign up. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/supporters. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is the show all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship. On this episode, we discuss COVID, David's Law, Dave Chappelle, and Scotland's miserable drinking laws. Hello, and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, and I'm here, as ever, with Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom. As ever. No getting rid of me.
Fortunately not. But we're very fortunate to be joined today by Charlie Peters, who's a columnist at Mail Plus, and I'm glad to also a regular contributor to Spiked. How are you doing, Charlie?
Very well, thank you. Great to be here.
So we've got a lot to talk about today. Some good news, I say that tentatively, on the COVID front. We're recording this on the Tuesday. We're still waiting for that 4 o'clock data to come out. But Chris, as you've been talking about in the media a fair bit this week, the signs are actually good for the minute. Cases seem to have been declining for a couple of days, seem to just kick in as soon as Keir Starmer called for more restrictions. Everything seems to pan out nicely. But do you want to just give us a sense of what the picture is at the moment and what things are looking like?
Well, it's early days, but the case numbers do look like they're going down. It's not a massive surprise to people who look closely at the data over the last week or so. The growth in cases was slowing down, particularly amongst kids and people under the age of 30. And, you know, and why not? You know, I mean, this, if it is a sustained fall, will be at least the third fall since July. I mean, it goes up, goes down. And people are, they seem to have like, they can't get out of the mentality of last year when there was just a very straightforward mathematical progression, you know, and case numbers would just double and double and double. And Chris Ritty was always saying that an epidemic is either doubling or halving. It hasn't doubled or halved for at least 3 months. You know, it's just been going up a bit and then down a bit and up a bit. And I'm not going to pretend I know where we go next with this or what's going to happen. It's conceivable we could get to 100,000 cases a day. And if we do, quite honestly, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to overwhelm the NHS to get to 100,000 cases a day. We've had all this bloody hysteria from NHS Confederation, which I'd never even heard of until last week. Matthew Taylor from the RSA and Moral Maze are suddenly some expert on the NHS. And the British Medical Association and a few other trade unions. And then eventually, as you say, the Labour Party got in just as cases were falling. And what was it based on? It was based on case numbers going back nearly to where they were the day before Freedom Day, 18th of July. Well, the government obviously didn't go into Plan B in July, so why would you expect them to go into it when we're in pretty much the same situation, if not better now? Well, we wouldn't do. And they're not going to. I'm really quite glad that we do, on this particular occasion, do have a government that's just going to ignore these people, because many governments, I'm sure, would have capitulated to this howling and screaming from journalists especially. Oh, the worst ones calling for this kind of stuff. No offense, Charlie. But, or indeed, Tom. But
I'm not calling
but
it that.
Pester, basically, yeah. Is what I'm talking about.
And bumbling other, his way through.
And other
as always.
People like him, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I really hope it goes down a lot. It's not going to go down to zero. You know, it's a bit, it's the same sort of 2020 mentality is on the other side, where you've got the, you know, anti lockdown, anti vaccine, whatever people who kind of go, oh, it's falling now. It will go down to almost zero like it did before. No, it went down to almost zero before because we had a lockdown. You just deny the lockdowns make any difference. But it's pretty obvious if you look at what's happened since June that this is nothing like what happened under lockdown. These things don't just naturally plummet down to zero. We're probably, I would think, just going to be you know, it'll probably go lower for a while, then it might go up a bit, it'll probably go up at Christmas. Yeah, who knows? It's very clear that the, you know, the rate of transmission, the RT, is and has been for a few months around one. And for the last few weeks, it's been a bit above one. Before that, it was a bit below one. It doesn't take much to push it either way. Mm. And obviously, more human interaction and colder weather is probably going to push it up a little bit. On the other hand, the booster shot program has actually been pretty successful.
Picking up a bit now.
Picking up a lot. And you can tell that in the hospital admissions data. And more people are getting infected. Roughly speaking, I think about 500,000 people are getting infected per week. You know, that adds up, you know, because that gives you the real natural immunity on top of the effect from the vaccines. I think we're in pretty strong position, actually, compared to Europe. I predicted last week that cases would fall this week and that in a month's time, most of Western Europe and certainly Eastern Europe, which is already doing really badly, is going to be in a worse position than us. I think that's largely because we actually have had several million infections over the course of late summer and autumn.
Charlie, what do you think about this? Because it feels like people in the sort of more lockdown fanatical side, they've invested so much in this unethical and dangerous experiment idea. I mean, it's been a gift to them, really, COVID, because they've been able to engage in this pantomime that the Tory government is basically just killing people at will. Is it just that they can't let that go? So whatever happens with the numbers, they have to still be all doom and gloom? What do you think?
I think Chris rightly pointed out that for the majority of the people who are most vociferous on this point, they tend to be journalists, right? And opposition politicians, who you'd expect. But journalists in particular, I think because they found that COVID is the one topic which has been allowed to stick to the government pretty much week in, week out, they can push in some line of attack. And let's not forget that the vast majority of the population is pretty nervous about COVID-19, even still. The polling throughout has always been that people are in favour of restrictions. Every single time there is this kind of YouGov pump that says people want this, people want that. And obviously, it's, you know, split by demographic and age, but generally speaking, people are in favour of this. So politicians see it as an easy win, an easy attack on the government, and journalists see it as probably the only thing that actually sticks. Mm. All other kind of scalp-halting assaults that they've tried on the Tory government for the last year and a half kind of haven't really worked at all. They couldn't even get, you know, Dominic Cummings out for breaking these restrictions. And so pushing for more.
They certainly tried.
They
couldn't have gone on about that much more.
But if you think that this story has been going on for too long, that flap has certainly, that's certainly continued way beyond its sell-by date. So yeah, I think it is, you know, a media-driven and a kind of an attack line-driven story. But if they actually considered perhaps beyond cases into hospital admissions and deaths, the kind of concern that actually should drive the discussion on this, there'd be no story whatsoever.
It does feel like even the mood has changed a little bit in the opinion polls, because you feel that people are more relaxed anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you talk about the things that people really associate with a lockdown, so closing businesses and shutting schools, you know, it's like around 20% or something like that, would people actually support? And the things that they do support are things that probably they think of as not that big of a hindrance, things that I don't want to see coming back in terms of masks or introduction of vaccine passports, things like that. But again, you can see in that the mood has changed. I think that's one of the reasons, Chris, that the government is a little bit more bullish. I mean, they don't say much openly, but you get the sense from the reporting that they're pretty relaxed at this point. Is it just because public opinion has shifted, do you think?
I think the government has been on the side of public opinion all year, pretty much. I think they made a fairly clear offer to the public in January, saying that we're going to have a lockdown. It's probably going to last quite a long time, but it's because we have vaccines. And once we have vaccines, this is going to be irreversible. Remember that? Nobody ever mentions that anymore. Boris said it was going to be irreversible. But he did, and I think he meant it at the time. I think it would take a really very unexpected catastrophe for him to row back on that. I still don't think we're going to see vaccine passports, although I guess we will if we do get up to very high numbers and the journalists keep on bleating about it. But I just think we should be optimistic at this point. I think it's quite conceivable that we will get down to quite low numbers, and that the virus has washed through the school kids and the younger people, basically the more social people. You know, they can only get it once for the most part. I know people can get reinfected, but generally speaking, you saw this with the Euros. People who got infected with Euros are people who just like partying, you know, and they don't care about social distancing. They go around people's houses, go into the game, whatever. They got it, and now they can't get it again. And that's how it's washing through society. And it's not so far affecting older people. And the third shot will make sure that, you know, it doesn't affect them over the course of winter. I think we're in a really good position. And I, you know, thoughts and prayers at this terrible time to Independent Sage and Robert Peston.
I mean, you do hope that they're getting, some of those people are getting more hysterical precisely because they are on the back foot. I mean, even now you're seeing this attempt to kind of import US style culture wars over masks and stuff like Billy Bragg tweeting that he doesn't wear a mask, that people don't confuse him for a Tory. I think Robin Ince took a picture of himself wearing a mask on a train, an empty train, saying we're wasting the benefits of the vaccine
so
program.
I got told off
for the first time for not wearing a mask the entire since the pandemic started, like last week on a train out of Waterloo.
Who by?
By a guard.
Busybody.
By a guard.
By a guard.
In an empty train, last train out of Waterloo, who was saying, even though you're in this carriage by yourself, the ventilation is such that it can go to other people on
a
the train.
Train. Or a
no, national one.
So you don't even legally have to wear one, right?
No. On I think on this one they do.
It's still TfL.
Yeah. No, it's Southwestern Railway, but they maintain that you have to wear it, I think.
I'd like to see them tell everybody off on TfL. Well, yeah, not wearing a mask.
Yeah, it was just a drunk bloke sat by himself and he thought this is going to be a moment. But you have seen this politicization of masks, which has come up as the incident has gone down.
Yeah.
And people making it. But people are voting with their faces. I mean, you just don't see the level of masks as you would even 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Even like buses are completely... I'm a huge bus guy in London, massive bus fanatic. And I barely see people with masks on the local services around here. So even though, the polling's getting more optimistic and people, even if you don't check that, if you just see what people are acting as, it's changing in a completely different direction.
And do you think, Charlie, that the government will be able to kind of carry on holding this line? Will they eventually give in to, as Chris was saying, the media or the pressure from the opposition, particularly if numbers tick up again? I mean, is this it?
I think for someone like me who was in favour of lockdowns very early on, very initially, in order to stop the spread of the virus before it got banned, before we had vaccines, I am now glad that we have leadership who are very, very cautious about imposing restrictions, even when they knew they had to, right? Even when Boris knew he had to serve the shit sandwich, he still kept it behind the bar for ages.
Wonderful.
Marinating, spinning in the microwave, going, it's going to ping any minute now, and then eventually handing it over. I think I'm finally glad that I'm being governed by someone who does not want to do that. And as the cases may fluctuate, generally, I think a positive direction, that pressure and the feeling he has inside to act in that way will only go down as well.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the pro-freedom, anti-woke person in your life? Then look no further than the Spiked Shop. You can now get your favourite Spiked slogan on a t-shirt, hoodie, tote bag or mug, including ban nothing, question everything, love Europe, hate the EU and cancel culture. Plus, if you're a Spiked supporter, you can get a 15% discount off of everything. Just go to spiked-online.com/shop to browse our items and make your purchases. That's spiked-online.com/shop. Without picking up on the theme of sewage and the government, which is a rich theme this week, unfortunately, let's move on and talk about online anonymity, which is a strange thing to be talking about because the prompt for it was the killing of David Amos, the Essex Tory MP, who was murdered. The police are treating it as a terrorist incident, suspected religious motivation in the jargon. But even though immediately it was quite clear that's what the police were treating this alleged crime as, the discussion was instantly about trolling, about people being nasty to MPs online. Some serious stuff, of course, within there around death threats and all the rest of it. But you had this really kind of surreal discussion which seemed to kick off, which seemed to be exclusively about what can we do about the internet in the wake of a real world act of horrendous violence. Chris, what did you make of all of this? And do you think we are going to see kind of pushes to regulate the internet more with this online safety bill and all the rest of it as a result of this?
It's becoming a bit of a pattern, isn't it? There's a tragic death and then politicians start calling for a clampdown on free speech. Because after the Sarah Everard murder, there was talk about making misogyny a hate crime, however the hell that would work, I've no idea. And then with David Amos, just like basically totally random policy proposal, just had nothing to do, as far as we know, with the man's murder whatsoever, and a lot to do with the fact that Marc Francois doesn't like being insulted and called lofty and stuff on Twitter, which he apparently does quite a bit. I'm sure Marc Francois gets an enormous amount of abuse on Twitter as a pro-Brexiteer, apart from anything else. And yeah, I'm sorry about that, but you just block them. Just block the people. I've blocked nearly 4,000 people about 3,000 just in the last 18 months. You know, sticks and stones, Mark, is all I'd say. To exploit it and call it David's law. You know, this David Amos was an MP for 38 years. If he wanted to do something about this, admittedly, the internet wasn't around for that entire period, I'll give you that. But if he wanted to do something about internet trolls, he would have tried to, you know, or he at least would have made some speeches about it or said something. But as far as I know, it wasn't anything. It wasn't of interest to him whatsoever. And even if it had been, I'm sorry, but you know, being murdered doesn't mean you get a law passed in your honour. It's one thing.
Your constituency gets to be a city.
South End. I'm not even sure that was right, really. I don't, who cares whether South End's a city or not? It just seemed that these things should go through a certain process rather than just being, you know, knocked through on the basis of somebody's death. But anyway, that's sort of beside the point. It's certainly true that we shouldn't bring in a really draconian anti-free speech law on the basis of a very tragic event that had absolutely nothing to do with Twitter trolls or any kind of speech that we know of. It's insane.
Angela Rayner calling Tories scum.
Yeah, that had nothing to do with it either. Everyone tries to weaponize every single time. It's one of these awful events happens, terrorism or anything like this. I just go, right, no more Twitter for me today or probably tomorrow because it's just going to be too infuriating watching every idiot with a bee in his bonnet trying to exploit this for his own ends.
But you can hang anything off it, can't you? Because, you know, since Brexit and probably a bit before, there's just been this argument you always hear, which is like there's this atmosphere out there.
There's this toxicity.
It's online.
Daily Mail front covers. I wonder why people are so violent in this show, like Enemies of the People. Daily Mail front page.
The saboteurs.
That's clearly what it was. I'm sure that the person who killed David Amos was inspired by 5-year-old pro-Brexit headlines in the Daily Mail.
Boris Johnson's paywall Telegraph articles, you know, have been inspiring.
His body wasn't even cold when these tweets were coming out. When influential and important people were saying that, there was Tories first and foremost, which was most regrettable to see people on my side, as it were, saying, this is Angela Rayner's fault. No one had been even arrested at this point. And people were blaming a Labour MP for calling them scum 2 weeks ago. Just finally, they thought, we can now use their tactics for our advantage. We can play the same game. That was very tragic. And then moving on to this whole idea about toxicity and all that stuff. The David's Law thing, it makes it sound like a little girl, you know, like the kind of laws you get after someone else is murdered. You get Ellie's Law or something like that. Megan's Law.
Well, usually those are related to the, to the circumstances.
Those actually make sense. But to David's Law, you know, a guy in his 60s who's not been killed by anything that's related to what they're complaining about. It is completely baffling.
I know we can't say anything for definite, but we do know that this is being treated as a terrorist incident, suspected religious motivation. And I don't doubt that some of these MPs, they do think about their own safety. They think about the kind of shit that they get in times like this. They kind of generalise it. But it's quite clear this isn't a generalisable crime in terms of how the police are treating it. And it is just obvious that whether it's consciously or unconsciously, whenever you see Islamist terrorism, suspected Islamist terrorism being talked about, the instant response is to deflect. I mean, the Observer had this horrendous editorial the Sunday after it happened, saying that anyone who would focus on these scant details that it was being treated as a matter of terrorism with this Islamist motivation potentially are basically wrong as we're trying to exploit you. But imagine if in the wake of the Joe Cox killing, people were saying, this guy shouted Britain first as he murdered her. It was quite clear he had far-right links. Someone said, well, that doesn't matter.
Let's focus on the toxic atmosphere and how fierce the Brexit debate has been.
We can't rush
to any decision, but let's rush to my agenda instead.
But then there's the anonymity thing as well, which is important to stress, isn't it? Because they just want to throw this out as if, first of all, it's easy to do. When the government were trying to put age limits on porn websites, they couldn't work that one out. They were at one point suggesting people go and buy a pass in their newsagent. They were so in the woods about how they were going to do it.
Very 90s energy to that.
But that is where people used to get that.
Exactly, right. Would it come in a little brown paper bag? I don't know. But the anonymity thing in particular, Charlie, what have you made of that discussion? What do you think would happen if they tried to do that?
I think they obviously want it to happen. I think it's clear that, Priti Patel probably is leaning in this direction. Any opportunity to kind of add in more restrictions to online harms. But the reason why I don't think it will happen, first and foremost, is because lots of people in the kind of blobby liberal sphere think that anonymity is important for, LGBT whistleblowers, for example, in media organizations, big corporations, the military, the law, police, et cetera, et cetera. What you'll find is that this debate, I think, will continue. People will make calls for it on both sides of the house. And then it'll get to a point when they realize this will upset people who we like.
Yeah.
And then they'll
There's
stop
a very
it.
Worthy case to make against it.
So well, there is a very worthy case to make it. But what I think will be...
In the good and bad sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. What I think will be quite funny is seeing kind of the anonymous accounts that I like that don't tend to be whistleblowers.
I dread to think what
they're <They're> great. some of the great accounts. But they're all going to rebrand as kind of gay whistleblowers, right? Everyone's going to be like, don't ban me. I'm looking on... I work for a big secretive organization and you won't believe the kind of suffering I endure. So it probably won't happen. And I'm glad it won't happen because it's a really stupid idea.
All right, news just in. I've just checked the new case numbers.
Good.
This won't be news for our listeners, but it's news for us. Down.
Yes.
36,000 last Tuesday. Nearly 37,000, actually, and 32,000.
32. Tiny numbers.
Sweet.
You shouldn't have doubted yourself at all. Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show.
I'll tell you what, let's completely change gear here and talk about Dave Chappelle.
yeah. And so this is natural.
This scandal has been rumbling on for at least 3 weeks now. I saw someone point out that, you know, the outrage over this is in America has been longer than the outrage over the withdrawal of Afghanistan. Yeah. And it's completely true. It never ends. So Dave Chappelle, legendary comedian, has this string of Netflix specials. His most recent one, The Closer, caused particular outrage because he did what he's done in most of his recent ones, it seems like, which is tell jokes about trans people in quite an unapologetic fashion. Workers at Netflix, some of the creatives there, staged this walkout. There was also a protest in solidarity with it outside. The Netflix bosses originally were putting up quite a good front, I think it was fair to say, saying that we don't believe our content contributes to real world harm. But now we've started to backtrack a little bit under the weight of all of this sort of moral pressure. So, Chris, what do you make of all of this? I mean, it
felt sticks
inevitable,
and stones, isn't it? I think that's one. Is that
the
name
was the previous
of one,
yeah, a couple of ones ago. Yeah,
but I mean, that really says it all. As far as I'm concerned, it was an all right special. I've seen all his specials, I think, now, and a lot of them have very good gags in it. I didn't think this had as many as the previous ones, and that's partly because he was bending over backwards to try and explain himself,
yeah,
and make it clear that he's not transphobic. He's just making jokes. But of course, in this current environment with all the bloody millennials and Zoomers around, you can't do that. The thing that strikes, protest and all this nonsense, it baffles me because I used to go to comedy clubs quite a bit in the 90s and early noughties. And then I sort of settled down. You have a family and children. Your entire social and cultural life just evaporates for years, you know. And the only comedy club I've been to in the last 10 years has been Comedy Unleashed, which has a reputation that we say anything and all that. But I go to Comedy Unleashed and it's brilliant. They have great acts on. But I just go, well, this is just like the normal comedy club. I mean, I don't really understand why this is so controversial. What are the other ones like, you know? And it's the same with Chappelle. It's just like the guy's doing, yeah, it's a bit edgy, but that's how you get laughs a lot of the time.
Yeah.
That's what makes people laugh, breaking taboos.
Yeah.
You know?
And he's joking. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean,
and he's obviously joking.
He begins that special talking about being abused as a child and enjoying it. And like, I don't think he's being sincere
don't
there
that
either,
joke.
You know. But it is still the sort of thing where you think, bloody hell, but Charlie, what have you made of all of this?
Well, I think it's been very miserable that soon after Norm Macdonald died, the discussion about comedy from a guy who did not hold his punches and was famously sacked for continuing on a very kind of non-PC line when executives didn't want him to, that after, you know, the praise from comics, the wide praise for this man's greatness, those same people have kind of fallen silent when this guy's, you know, Chappelle's come under criticism for what he said. And I watched it last night and I didn't think it was particularly good. So we complain a lot, I think, on our side about kind of the clap, don't laugh comedy that you see, right?
Mm.
And the comedy that has infected establishment media, 8 out of 10 cats, Mock the Week. It's just people who want to, left-wing people generally, left liberals, who want to have a go at politicians. What Chappelle did is basically the same, but from a kind of like, right-wing, mildly right-wing, critical, gender-critical stance of being like, maybe trans people are a bit mental sometimes. That's about as edgy as it got, right? And I think this is true as a grave understatement, but he did it in a way which was like apologetic. Mm. As Chris said, every time he makes a joke, he spends 30 seconds on the joke and then 2 minutes being like, I love trans people. Some of my best friends are trans people. You know, it'd be nice, I think, you know, if you could actually just tell jokes trying to cover for yourself. Because yeah. it turns comedy into this kind of, well, obviously it's a routine, but a routine of kind of self-immolation. So you're like, I'm so sorry I've said that. It was funny, wasn't it? But I'm so sorry. Let me explain why I'm allowed to say that. Mm. So it's dull. It's dull. And I'd rather we had more just laugh comedy, less clap and don't laugh comedy.
There was definitely a bit of clapter in this, some people call it in this one. But he's quite, I think Dave Chappelle is absolutely brilliant, but he's quite uneven. Yeah. So sometimes he's absolutely brilliant, sometimes it's terrible. But one thing that I think is interesting is I wouldn't say necessarily was sort of apologising, because he has come out fighting in a way that you only really can if you're a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
With a lot to lose, but not many ways to lose it, if you see what I mean. So it was that, the recent statement he made was that he said he'd meet the trans community if they wanted to, but he won't be summoned. And his one of his conditions for meeting them would they have to admit that Hannah Gadsby isn't funny.
Yeah.
And in that moment, you see that, you do, unfortunately, in this culture, have to rely on filthy rich people to hold the line to a certain degree.
Yeah, in a way you do. This came up at the Battle of Ideas. It was Andrew Doyle and Simon Evans and a couple of other people talking about this issue. And they were saying that you've got to have fuck you money, basically, in order to speak your mind in comedy anymore. But I sort of said from the floor, like, you know, Simon Evans, Andrew Doyle, they're obviously not at Dave Chappelle's level, but they've built up an audience over a period of years because they're funny, very good comedians. Mm. And they're not being cancelled. You know, they can say effectively what they want. So isn't the solution to this just for young comics to just be funny for a few years? Don't be that controversial, but be funny. And then once you've built up an audience like Ricky Gervais and Simon and Andrew have done, you can say what you want. You can't actually be cancelled once you've got an audience. And comedians have always been fighting against a culture of censoriousness in one respect or other. Probably in the 90s, it was less of that than ever before. But even then, there was a political correctness coming in. You know, people like Jim Davis and Bernard Manning couldn't get on TV for love of money. Mm. So there's always been an establishment. There's always been some sort of conservatism. At the moment, it's kind of the progressive conservatism. But you know, Lenny Bruce and Bill Hicks and all these people are always fighting against that's what makes it funny. The fact that you've got something to fight against, you make jokes about it, and actually you don't get cancelled. People just laugh, and they like you, and you get an audience. And nobody gave me a very good reply to that point. And I've been thinking about it since, and I think, and I hate to just agree with myself, I think it's a really good point.
Well, there are these kind of like, you know, progressive angels and little Jesuses you can't criticise anymore. That's where the progressive conservatism comes in. Dave Chappelle took a swipe at one of those little Jesuses, which is trans people.
Yeah.
But Simon Evans went to Newcastle like 10 years ago and said they were all entitled to disability allowance because of their accents as a very posh man. No one had a go at him because he was taking the piss out of working class people in a way that they thought was funny.
Oh, but you're allowed to do that.
Precisely. But
do like the BBC any day. I wondered, because I was thinking about that, Chris, because I was in that session. On the one hand, I think people are a little bit shocked because it's so narrow. You know, it's the sort, and it's happened quite quickly.
Yeah.
And also, I guess, because it's within your own peer group or whatever, in a way that, you know, if it was left wing liberal comics and there's the kind of religious right over here wailing, that's something that you can kind of understand. But if it's from the people within your own industry, I can understand why they're particularly smarting from that. But you're right, as far as, you know, at least it creates some kind of friction, which is useful. But I guess it's one of the things we should probably talk just briefly before we move on about the protests, because they were quite funny in a lot of ways, if nothing else. I mean, first of all, the stuff that some of these protesters were coming out with, there was this great line from one of the organisers, which was, we're not here because we can't take a joke, we're here because these jokes are taking lives, or something to that effect. It's a perfect crystallisation of what we're talking about. Which also proves that they can't take a joke, obviously, if you think about that. But, and then also there was this hilarious situation where these two kind of YouTube comics showed up as a counter protest with these We Like Dave signs.
Someone is funny.
Someone pulled his side off, then handed his stick back to him and said, he's got a weapon. Someone walks up to him, you know, that, all of this kind of stuff.
He's got a stick.
This is the marketplace of ideas that we've seen performed in the US so much since 2015, right? Of two groups on extreme sides. Even if one side is significantly less extreme than the other, like the We Like Jokes people.
Yeah.
Meeting
what
in public.
Insane
people. Meeting together in public and just screaming at each other and hitting each other. Yeah, I think what was funny is, as you said, so narrow, such a small group of people. having such a big effect, combining all the hostility of masculinity with with the fragility of femininity. So good for them. They're doing it right. But unfortunately, though they may be a small and very embattled group, they have a ginormous support from the AP, the New York Times, the Washington Post, who will blatantly lie about what the opposition are doing. I mean, in some of the photo captions that the AP produced of these protests at Netflix headquarters, there's a guy holding his hands up, one of the counter protesters. I can't believe I'm saying that to describe it. One of the comic counter protesters. And he was like, and the caption is something like, you know, counter anti-trans protest that prepares to, you know,
shouts obscenities or whatever it was.
You know, it's just like, come on. So they can get away with it because they know they've got ginormous establishment support. They're in the driving
seat. Yeah, and you look at some of those videos, there seem to be more journalists than protesters. But I guess they've just given the unfortunately, a lot of these institutions have just conceded the point that speech is violent, really, in one way.
So I'm not fully on board with the kind of sticks and stones point. I think, you know, words aren't violent. They can be harmful. You can be upset. Words can make you sad and they can change your, you know, your day-to-day life. But
they don't break your bones.
But they don't break your bones. They don't break your bones.
I just remember that Jim Davison was presenting Big Break all the way through the 1990s. So I'd just like to retract.
We appreciate your.
It's important. It's important. Transparency. You're accurate on this podcast.
And then they sent him to Helmand Province when the gigs dried up.
And now he's having set twos of Ashley Bandra from this. But anyway, let's talk about. Let's get into the sort of nanny state corner of the podcast.
Remember when we used to be a nanny state podcast?
Yeah, we used to be 100%. We've been slowly pushing back against that for years. No, but let's talk about two stories. Let's start off with Heads Up, which is almost like a kind of NAF pilot play school social credit system.
I hate it when people say Heads Up.
So do you want to tell us a bit about this? This is an app. It's a £3 million pilot for you to be able to kind of track all of your various good healthy eating and exercise things and rack up points and rewards. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
It's a government Fitbit, basically. and they're going to give you gym passes and cinema tickets and clothes vouchers and stuff. If you put more veg in your shopping basket, and if you reduce your portion sizes, I don't know how that's going to be monitored. And if you take more steps, I guess they can monitor that. That's a Fitbit thing. So they're doing a trial next year for 6 months, and they're going to see how it goes. So £3 million isn't very much in the great scheme of things, but this is only for the trial. And to do it nationwide, I would imagine it's going to cost tens of billions of pounds. Yeah. If you're going to give people cinema tickets and clothes vouchers and things. So on one level, it's quite trivial and it probably won't work because it's a government IT project. It'd probably be an absolute fiasco. But on another level, if it's even seen to work, if they get a few people consuming more carrots for a bit or walking a bit more to the tobacconist, then I guess they will expand it. And it's actually, if you really, if you project forwards and think, what would it be like if they actually do make this a national scheme that anyone can opt into? It's pretty Orwellian, really. And not just Orwellian, but also it's, if you're like me and you're not going to opt into it, I'm going to end up paying more tax to give people tickets to Alton Towers because they're buying, but not necessarily consuming more vegetables. I think it's wide open to low level fraud. I don't know how they're going to really police. Well, they can't police what people are actually eating, even if they can sort of check what people are buying. And you end up with a two-tier system, a two-tier society, where people like me are being taxed to pay for people who probably go to the gym anyway to go to the gym. This is a problem with a lot of these systems. It distributes wealth upwards because the kind of people who opt into apps and the kind of people who have Fitbits, let's face it, I don't know what the social class divide is on Fitbits, but I'm suspecting it's not.
Suspecting Charlie has one.
I've got views on this.
I remember your protein shakes from Spike's intern.
Would
be a big beneficiary of this game. Right. Do you want to hold thoughts on this for a
second? I can't see myself getting involved in a fitness-based social credit score system. I do it for myself, not for Downing Street, I think, generally speaking, when it comes to health and fitness. I don't own a Fitbit. I think enough of my life is tracked, as it were, through my phone, laptop, what I tap in, what I tap out. And also, I have a mildly autistic obsession with personal statistics, right? And I found that if I had something that measured every step I took, I would get into it a little bit unhealthily. And I would start to clock up, you know, averages, and, you know, it would be very bad for me. So I've not delved into it. And the thought of paying tax for someone else to delve into it makes me deeply unimpressed. But yeah, I think your Spectator article on, Chris, on the heads up thing about how this will just reward people who already do this stuff is so completely true. Because, yeah, exactly. The people who already own Fitbits are the people who like this stuff. It's not, and if it's opt-in, the people who the government think needs to lose weight aren't going to choose to do extra walks or extra carrots for the government's benefit. And it is part, I think, as you also raised, with this kind of weird obsession with weight that has happened since the pandemic started as well. Obviously, there were the usual health Nazis who were really obsessed with what we looked like, what we ate, what we drank. But they've been given power, like new power.
Bottomless power.
Endless power.
The government will just accept any policy these people come up with now, because Boris Johnson was in hospital for a few days.
And he's fat again as well, for goodness sake. He's fat again.
Yeah, he didn't lose any weight at all.
He had a haircut. I find it's the best way to lose it, actually. Have a haircut.
That's a loss of weight in a way, but it's pretty negligible.
Yeah, pretty negligible. But he looked a little bit trim. He went on holiday and he's come back looking absolutely stinking.
People always put the weight back on.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time.
Yeah. Don't bother. Don't get ahead.
Well, it just seems to me inevitable.
Yeah. Well, either way, there is this new obsession with the kind of...
I lost a lot of weight a few years ago. Put it all back on. You just do it. You find your natural weight and that's it. Just live with it.
Live and die
with it.
Yeah.
So before we punch out of here, Chris, we should talk about minimum pricing. So there's been a latest bit of research proving it seems like it's a complete waste of time.
Charlie wrote it first, because he wrote a very good article for Spiked about this, and then I'll chip in with some brand new research fresh off the press today.
Yeah. So Charlie, I think you know, the research is in Scotland. So it's about the minimum unit pricing in Scotland a few weeks ago for Spiked. And every now and again, studies are produced on this issue in Scotland. And another nail in the coffin was they found that it had no observable effect on crime and disorder. Now, when they launched minimum unit pricing, sure, the government was saying this is more about health, as ever, right? But many of its supporters said this will help cut down on the problem, what they believed of kind of like the urban strife.
The models that they were using explicitly said it would reduce crime by 350 crimes a year in the first year.
And it's had none effect whatsoever, basically. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And it's been around for 6 years
And this
now.
Is the official, if I'm, no, not quite that one. It's 3 years.
2018, 3 years now, yeah. And it's had none of this effect. I mean, I spent best part of 5 years living in Scotland when many of these schemes were introduced. And it's miserable. It's miserable. everything. And a country that you really actually need to drink in to get by, because it's so freezing and the sun's only around for 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
It's quite nice
to
be able to,
you know,
they're not worth talking about. It's very nice to be able to actually afford a drink. And if they let you buy one, because you can't buy drinks from supermarkets after 10 p.m. or before 10 a.m. So if you hadn't planned ahead, you're stuffed. You have to go to the pub and spend more for a pint than you would in London in some cases, Edinburgh and Glasgow. It's crazy. So yeah, it's a miserable system and it doesn't work. That's not sure. What's the latest research?
The latest, thanks for asking. the latest came out today, and again, part of the official Public Health Scotland funded evaluation, which I have to say has been pretty good so far. It's actually made me think that the public health movement is not quite as corrupt as I thought it was, because they're not pretending it is working, really. But they are, in, as you'll see in a moment, they are very much burying bad news. So this is a study primarily looking at emergency hospital admissions. The abstract says, this study found that implementation of minimum unit pricing at 50p per unit was unproblematic, with no evidence of beneficial or harmful impacts on the outcomes evaluated. So no evidence of beneficial impacts is pretty bad to start with, right, for policies that cost Scottish drinkers tens of millions of pounds. But then you get to the results. And it says, the odds ratio for an alcohol-related emergency department attendance following minimum unit pricing was 1.14. That means it was a 14% increase. In absolute terms, we estimated that minimum unit pricing was associated with 258 more alcohol-related emergency department visits across Scotland than would have been the case had minimum unit pricing not been implemented.
Wow.
This is really not what these researchers were looking to find. I recognize some of the names of the authors, and they definitely would be unhappy with this. And you can tell that, because they get to the conclusion and they basically say, actually, we didn't find anything, even though they clearly found a statistically significant increase in these hospital admissions. And they conclude by saying, the lack of effect observed in these settings in the short term and the problem-free implementation suggests that the price per unit set, 50p, was acceptable, but maybe too low. The medicine didn't work. More medicine.
But it speaks so well to the kind of SNP's control of Scotland, and that so much of the country is going to shit. I mean, in vast and plentiful ways. I mean, Glasgow this week is reporting a massive rat-related issue in the streets. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
The council leaders being saying that Thatcher's to blame for rats.
Margaret Thatcher.
There was a guy saying that every city has rats. It does, but they're not all biting bin men.
Exactly. Or walking up the stairs. And so
there's an amazing quote, which is like, she had a non-serious contact with a rat or something, but still had to go to hospital. It was something like that. I can't remember exact wording.
Imagine what actually had a serious contact with a rat.
I'm taking him out.
A mere rat brush. just one of those. The day-to-day standard.
Rat skirmish. Right,
in this madness. You
they
know,
squared off a bit in that.
Hamburg.
Rats everywhere. Health system on its knees. You know, soldiers driving hospitals. Crime's a bit of a disaster as well. And no one goes to uni unless they're English. Yours truly. with all this going on, they still dedicate enormous amounts of resources to just punishing people for going for a beer. Backwards, silly country. I'd love to go back, but not.
You won't be welcome.
But not while they're in charge.
On that cheery note, let's leave it there. Chris, Charlie, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.